In 2009, I had done a biography of Dabney and the church in Holland. I listened to that yesterday, and it's pretty full. I dealt with his work, A Defense of Virginia in the South, and so on. So this isn't going to be so much biographical as kind of delving into his writings, how he had somewhat of a prophetic view of the future and the things that would come to pass because of the incoming of what he called the New South. In 1902, there was this Reverend Samuel Mills Tenney, and he was in bookshop in Houston, Texas, typical Presbyterian, and we would say Reformed Baptist too, who loves books. And he saw in the corner a stack of papers which drew his attention. We just went through something like this before, and somebody who was writing to Whitfield and saw a stack of books that were about to be thrown out. So Pastor Tenney inquired about it. He learned that these manuscripts were destined for destruction. He was going to throw them all out. And the owner was comforted that the curious person desired to relieve him of the trouble of disposal. So Tenney blew the dust off, tied the packets of papers into a large armful, and triumphantly carried his prize home. In the study of his manse, he made a startling discovery. The aging papers belonged to the Southern Presbyterian theologian Robert Louis Dabney. This revelation troubled Tenney, who thought to himself, is this the way our church treats her great men? In our day, Dabney's name has fallen on tough times, and he's not so much looked as a great man, but I still derive so much from him. I had gotten his discussions way back in 1984 and started reading him very early on in my Christian pilgrimage. Well, last Thursday was his 200th birthday. He was born March 5th, 1820 in Louisa County, a son of Elizabeth Randolph Price Dabney and Charles Dabney, a member of the county court and an elder in the local Presbyterian church. At age 7, he began his education in a small log school near his home. Morton Smith, who teaches or taught at Greenville Seminary, in his studies in Southern Presbyterian theology, is talking about Dabney as well as Thornwell, and he says, because Dabney lived a lot longer, Thornwell only lived to be 50 years of age. And so Smith says, for this reason, Dabney may have exerted even greater influence on the successive generations than Thornwell. His special forte was the teaching of theology. The Presbyterian Banner of Pittsburgh said, several times we have heard the late Reverend Archibald Alexander, catch that name, Archibald Alexander, says that he regarded him, Dr. Dabney, as the best teacher of theology in the United States, if not in the world. Well, they put that quote in the writings of Dabney every time Banner of Truth published some of his work. So I wrote to the editors of the Banner of Truth and questioned that Archibald Alexander said that. And the reason I questioned it was because Alexander died in 1851. Dabney never even started teaching theology till later in the 1850s. So the correct person who regarded him was Archibald Alexander Hodge, the son of Charles Hodge. And yet I still hear him, Archibald Alexander, is referring to Dabney as this great systematic theologian. When Ian Murray taught his lecture on Dabney years ago, he said the same thing. But it was in 1853 he was called to fill the chair of ecclesiastical history and polity after the death of Graham. He really didn't even have his first pastorate until the year 1846. So he began to teach church history and polity, Hampton Sydney College. He was engaged in writing for various church papers. He also actively filled the pulpit and carried out pastoral work for the college church at Hampton Sydney. His ability as a teacher of theology was early recognized. Princeton Seminary sought him for the chair of church history in 1860. And in 1859, James Waddell Alexander, the son of Archibald Alexander, who we introduced last week, had passed away, and the church tried to call Dabney to that pastorate in New York, but he wasn't going to leave the South. He wasn't going to leave Virginia, especially with war or rumors of war on the horizon. But again, I stated that he isn't as respected in our day, and I was looking up a number of online biographies of Dabney, and one of them came out of the Desiring God Ministries. It was somebody not normally attached to that ministry, but really reminded me of the story of John Wycliffe, that when Wycliffe died, it would have been too unpopular for the Roman Catholic Church to do anything to his body. So they waited 43 years later, and they dug up his bones and burned them and then threw them on the Swift River. Well, that's what these social justice people seem to do with Dabney. They dig up his reputation and put a revisionist history on it and try to damage it. And in the same article, they were comparing him to Martin Luther King Jr. and talking about what a social justice warrior comparatively Martin Luther King Jr. was, which is very sad, because Martin Luther King Jr. didn't really show any signs of being an evangelical Christian. He was living in sin at the time of his death. I don't even know how you could say Dabney and Martin Luther King Jr. in the same breath. But anyway, the Union Theological Seminary awarded Dabney a Doctor of Divinity in 1852, and in August of the following year, he joined the faculty as Professor of Church History and Church Government. In 1859, he took over the duties of the Chair of Theology and began teaching systematic theology with a rigorous emphasis on Calvinist orthodoxy. Well, this is an Encyclopedia of Virginia, so they're not going to be highly favorable of Dabney, but at least some of these things are fair and they're useful to get a overview. He declined offers of a prestigious pulpit in New York, so that would have been J.W. Alexander. And he declined offers at least three times, I think. Charles Hodge tried to get him to Princeton Theological Seminary to teach, and he turned it down. Well, Dabney and Thornwell had one thing in common. Neither of them were for secession of the South. And they only, in the case of Dabney became a champion of the Southern stand after it was inevitable that Virginia was going to enter into the Civil War, and Dabney being such a person of Virginia, of course he sided with Virginia in the Civil War. In May of 1861, he began 4 months of service as chaplain to the 18th Virginia Infantry. So I wasn't really clear for a while on, you know, people used to talk about him as being Stonewall Jackson's chaplain. But the fact is, he was a chaplain in the Civil War first, and Stonewall Jackson knew of him and heard him preach and then asked him to be his chief of staff. Well, during the war, Thomas Jackson's wife lived with Dabney's wife because they were actually related. So it made sense that after Stonewall Jackson passed away, that his widow would approach Robert Dabney because of the respect that Stonewall Jackson had for him and ask him to write his biography, which if for no other reason, you want to increase your command of the English language, read a lot of Dabney. I mean, the detail in that book is really impressive. His command of the English language, we've fallen on hard times that way. I know that is certainly so for myself. But this morning I want to focus just on Dabney's insights into education and the changing of the Old South. In an article called "Was Dabney a Prophet?" Zachary Garris, June 19th, 2019, the writings of Robert Louis Dabney, often read like prophecy. After the war between the states, Dabney wrote essays on a variety of cultural and political issues, both in defense of the South and as an assault on progressivism. Along the way, he made predictions regarding the secularization of public schools, the future of feminism, and the decline of religious freedom. He wrote several essays on education, with the greatest being Secularized Education, for Libby's Princeton Review in 1879. That name is interesting to me, Libby's Princeton Review. What had happened was the biblical repertory in the Princeton Review had kind of a new beginning. And that's why a lot of the stuff that's scanned and put on the biblical repertory site for Princeton doesn't include these later volumes. So it took a while for me to find the 1879 essay that he did on secular education, and then I realized it's right there in his discussions, volume 4. Well, Dabney had opposed the public school movement taking place in Virginia for several reasons. First and foremost, he argued that education belongs to parents and the private sector. Interestingly, Virginia never even had any kind of public schools until after the Civil War. And so later on in his life, this is why Dabney was taking a stand against what he see would be inevitable if public schools gained the ascendancy. He argued that true education has a Bible at its foundation and moral formation as its end, and he knew public schools would inevitably become secularized. Well, the first person he wrote against was the superintendent of schools in Virginia, William Ruffner. Dabney said the logic was that public schools would be educating children from a variety of religious persuasions, including different Christian denominations, and only the least common denominator would be allowed, namely atheism. The Supreme Court prohibited Bible reading and prayer from public schools in the 1960s, but that wouldn't have made any difference to Dabney, because even if you got prayer back into the public school, in Dabney's mind, there shouldn't be public schools. Dabney predicted almost a century prior the type of things that would happen if there was going to be public education. It wouldn't have surprised him at all that in a number of years the Bible would have been taken out of the public schools. Nearly all public men and theologians almost a century prior. All public men and divines declare that the state schools are the glory of America, that they are a finality and in no event to be surrendered. And we have seen that their complete secularization is logically inevitable. Christians must prepare themselves then for the following results. All prayers, catechisms, and Bibles will ultimately be driven out of the schools. So Boyd Cathy wrote this article on June 25th, 2019, and as I'm studying these persons' commentaries on the writings of Dabney, I just found this guy very, very helpful. I woke up in the middle of the night, as I normally do on a Sunday morning, and started rereading an article he wrote, and I said, I just don't have the intelligence to be able to put something like this together. You'd have to know so much of the historic background that was going on after the Civil War. But he wrote on the topic of public education in his debate, Dabney, with Virginia's first superintendent of public instruction, William Ruffner, in the mid-1870s. His commentary is undergirded by his profound understanding that the so-called public education could not and never would be neutral when it comes to religion. State-run education not only usurped the God-given rights and solemn responsibility of the parents over the education of their children, but would, he foresaw, devolve into basically what we see today, anti-Christian and anti-family indoctrination. Well, is that ever true in our public schools in our day? And Dabney saw this coming. He also said, more so, state-run education sought to impose an unnatural equality on all. The term they use is egalitarianism, and people look at this and they say Dabney didn't believe in equality. Not the way it is being defined in our day. In our day, equality is being defined that there are no superiors and there are no subordinates. And this has gone so far that we bring illegal aliens into this country and we treat them as equal to us and therefore should have the rights of us, even though they're here illegally, because egalitarianism has been so misconstrued. But Dabney says, if the state undertakes to countervail that legislation of nature by leveling action, the attempt is wicked, mischievous, and futile. Indeed, Dabney questioned whether the use merely of letters is not education, but only one means of education and not the only means. True education involved more than simply the use of letters. Most citizens had traditionally found education through their various professions, a training of the moral virtues by the fidelity and endurance with which they earned their livelihood. The laboring man ennobles his tastes and sentiments by looking up to the superior who employs him. If to these influences you add the awakening, elevating, expanding force of a Christian principle, you have given the laborer a true education, a hundredfold truer, more suitable, more useful than the communication of certain literary arts, which he will almost necessarily disuse. Every Christian knows that such an education is virtually anti-Christian. To it, Christians can give place by subjection, no, not for an hour. Should that contingency become actual and catch us without efficient Christian schools of learning, Christian truth would experience a disastrous overthrow before this accomplished godless learning, backed up by the resources of the state. Christianity must keep up its bulwarks, said Washington, George Washington, in peace, prepare for war. One last paragraph and I'll go on to the second point. In what age, by what sect, where, when, and by whom has religious truth been excluded from the education of youth? Nowhere, never. Everywhere and at all times it has been regarded as essential. It is of the essence, the vitality of useful instruction. And this was not the assertion of Mr. Webster, the politician, but of the learned lawyer face to face with able opponents and making one of the most responsible forensic efforts of his life. He knew that he was uttering the weighty voice of history and jurisprudence. So I was saying that Ruffner engaged in this public debate with Dabney. They were friends and an influential Presbyterian minister, Dabney. Dabney called for the elimination of public schools because of their costs and because they threaten the social order. Ruffner countered with a series of articles in the Richmond's Dispatch and Inquirer that the state had a moral imperative to educate all of its citizens. To Ruffner, Dabney replied in a series of fine articles in the Richmond Inquirer. In the first of these, while declaring, I am an advocate for the state's providing, if necessary, all the aid for children's schooling, which it is really desirable and will be really utilized by them, that is, upon the old Virginian plan. He maintains that the promise of universal education by the Underwood system is delusive and mischievous, and so on. Moving on to Dabney and the New South, because this sermon is an amazing sermon. Now, in his mind, he had been developing the things. This wasn't a sermon. It was an address to the students graduating at Hampton, Sydney, quite a time after the Civil War. But he had been working on these sentiments and his teaching for some time. So this essay called The New South, a discourse delivered at the annual commencement of Hampton Sydney College, June 15, 1882, before the Philanthropic and Union Literary Societies. Now the history and the framing of this delivery of this speech is worth hearing, and we have it substantially in Dabney's own words. So this is the story here. I'd been spending parts of May and June in 1882 in a laborious preaching tour in southern and western North Carolina. I reached home the Saturday before college commencement pretty well broken down. I had a missionary appointment for the next day down at Brown's Church in Cumberland County, 15 miles off. But Saturday afternoon, a committee of the Philanthropic Society came rushing over to beg me to deliver the main commencement address on Wednesday. It was their year to choose a speaker. they had struck too high, selecting first one and then another big politician. So they had already tried to get two other big politicians to come and speak who backed out and refused. So here they were without any speaker at all. And the union man who had succeeded grandly the previous year, flouting them for their failure, I said to them, were I not a good-natured old man, I should view it thus, that you really do not think me fit to represent you, if you could get anybody else. You wish to do with me as a housekeeper does when company comes and she has a skimpy dinner. She trots out her cold south, sooth, not because it is much eating, but it covers a place on the naked board. Well, I will be your cold sooth, provided your president will sanction your selection. They said, of course he will, gladly. What is the use of such a proviso? I said to them, perhaps not so much, of course, as you think. You think very rightly that there ought to be no doubt of the acceptance of a man who has lived here 29 years, who has given his services and his money to the college, who has twice acted successfully as its temporary president. But we shall see what we shall see. Well, Monday afternoon, here came Dr. Atkinson with hot but embarrassed zeal to tell me that before he could give his consent, he must know what my topic and its treatment were to be. In other words, by this time, Dabney had already fallen out of favor with Hampton-Sydney College, and they were worried about this man being a cantankerous, bitter old man, and they did not ask him whether he made such a demand to Speaker Thomas Bacock and so on, others that you had come to speak. I told him very good-naturedly my topic and treatment, whereupon he said I might speak. I suppose he thought, or some fool told him, that I would discuss the Yankee Assembly with his resolutions and so on. Of course, I had taste and judgment enough not to drag in so alien a subject upon a college commencement platform. Having now but parts of 2 days, I attempted to write nothing. The speech was extempore. It's amazing. This is really makes an impression on me that this speech was extempore. In other words, this came out of his mind. If you read this essay, the brilliance of it, the command of the English language, the things that were communicated shows, to me at least, that this was one of the greatest minds in the 19th century. And I've held that opinion of Dabney for some time. This man's mind was certainly up there, to me anyway, as a Jonathan Edwards. So Wednesday came and they gave me the very end of the afternoon with a tired and listless audience. The audience is already worn out. They're hardly ready to pay attention. When I rose, Dr. Atkinson rose in his place, far forward, and stalked down the aisle with an air of ostentatious protest. In other words, I'm protesting that Dabney's about to speak. Being a cantankerous, hard old man, I never asked nor hinted the slightest amends from him for this public slight. But as soon as I began, I waked up my audience and held them to the end. This is my speech on the New South. When I closed, a large part of the audience was in tears. One after another of the great trustees came and took my hand and wrung it. While the tears were running down their cheeks, some sobbed aloud, unable to control their feelings. I afterwards wrote the speech out at Charlie's request, and he had it nicely printed in Raleigh. Well, that address is in the what's called Secular Discussions, Volume 4 of the Discussions of Dabney. And if you are familiar with the Discussions of Dabney printed by the Banner of Truth, there is no Volume 4. And why they're called secular, I don't pretend to know. Maybe questionable to some or whatever, but some of his greatest thinking is in Discussions, Volume 4. Just a quote from this essay: as we thus look back upon the social revolution which had established itself in our century, we see that political revolution had become unavoidable. The assault on our rights and institutions was but the first wave of the cataclysm. It swept over our best resistance because there were other waves behind it which are destined in turn to conquer our conquerors. He is a shallow man indeed who supposes that the revolution will pause at its present stage, leaving the conquering section ascendant and rendering this unstable equilibrium of the moment permanent, and so on. Well, there's three things that he addresses that he was concerned that was going to come upon our country, and each of them need to be defined. For those not familiar with the words, agrarian, he was worried that we were going to be removed from an agrarian society. That means these industries would come in, like up in the north, take over the south, and this was already pushing south. And an agrarian society would be pushed out of its ascendancy. And so there wouldn't be any use anymore so much for the farmer. They were looking for the factory. Well, with the driving out of this agrarian society would be an emphasis to do away with the patriarchy. By patriarchy, the definition is that man would no longer be the leader in the home. The other thing that he addressed was this false egalitarianism. He didn't deny that all men are created equal. It's just a way that that had been redefined. In other words, as I said before, all men, women, slave, illegal alien in our day, they're all equal, so they all have the same rights. There is no superior and there is no subordinate. And Dabney saw this coming. He said, the North triumphed by its wealth and the war. Here's the temptation to the New South, to which I already see ominous symptoms of yielding to make wealth the idol, the all-in-all of sectional greatness. Now, admittedly, Dabney never got over the defeat of the South in the Civil War. The war for Southern independence had been waged, he said, to save the liberties transmitted by our fathers. But in 1865, the South lay prostrate, its proud people defeated, its institutions and traditions uprooted. The old South of agrarian virtues had been bested by modernity in the form of Northern bayonets. In fact, the term that Dabney would use is they're taking their principles and they're shoving them down our throat by the edge of a bayonet. A new South would arise in the 1870s and the 1880s. It was Dabney's role during these years, holding fast unshakable convictions of his civilization, to question the basic values of this new South. I am the Cassandra of Yankeedom. That's the Cassandra. That's a mythical character in the Greek. She was always prophesying, but nobody would listen to her. And Dabney referred to himself as a Cassandra of Yankeedom, predestined to prophesy truth and never to be believed until too late, he said in 1894. So the tenets of the New South that Robert Dabney was attacking, whether industrialism, one thing that he worried about industrialism, monopolies, is that he didn't think it was going to be good for these major metropolitan areas like New York City to be the financial centers of the entire country. And for the monopolies that were starting to take place, educational reform, and as I said before, egalitarianism. Now, these had existed in the South before the war. In those days, however, plantation agriculture had been the unchallenged king. Now, the defeat of the South had given rise to strong doubts as to the basis for Southern society. The North had proved the value of industry in a recent conflict. There was a realization that, in the words of a Carolina planter, Ben Alston, we must begin at the beginning. We must make a new start. Already in the years immediately following the war, at least one prominent Southern magazine advocated a reorientation of Southern economics. So they were pushing to make the South like what you had in the North, and Dabney saw this coming. First, the true relation between God and man had been distorted by this egalitarianism. There was no such thing as real human equality, Dabney repeated, and to attempt to impose it was to violate the laws of God and nature. The effects of such efforts were disastrous to society. And the second adverse condition Dabney saw was the growth of financial oligarchy. Here Dabney drew a comparison between the United States of 1789 and 93 years later in 1882. In the former year, no one city, no one or two states, no handful of corporate giants controlled the nation's wealth. But in 1882, New York City had become the commercial mistress of the whole nation, and a handful of industrial financial barons dictated policies to the presidents. They had such power, it was affecting politics. So Dabney asked, can a sensible man persuade himself that political independence and individual initiative shall remain in a land where financial despotism has become established? So this brought Dabney to a third adverse condition, the destruction of true republican government and the establishment of what he saw as a political and managerial oligarchy. The word oligarchy means a small group of people having control of a country, an organization, or an institution. Concentrated wealth provided almost unlimited opportunity for a powerful few to sway and manipulate the public. In post-war America, it was but an easy step to observe that the oligarchies of wealth would now control politics as well. Is it Washington or Wall Street, exclaimed Dabney, which really dictates what platforms of the political party shall be set forth and what candidates shall be elected and what appointments shall be made? For certain, it is not the people of the states. This Zachary Garris, who's commending four of these essays by Dabney, actually recently wrote a book, and I was listening to an interview of him on YouTube. And this book is called Dabney on Fire, and he looks at Dabney and parental responsibilities, secular education, and the New South, and so on, and showing the strong points of Dabney's writings. Another thing that concerned him was universal suffrage. And whether we agree with this or not, I think his point was that if you give everybody the right to vote, but the same people that do that also are attacking a patriarchal society, then the type of people who are going to rise up to vote are going to be those people who are pushing feminism. He had an article called Women's Rights Women. And the other problem, and Doug and I were talking about this the other day, if you take people who are on welfare or people who are on the public dole of the state and so on, and you give them the same right to vote, they have no interest in what's good for the society at large, but what's good for their personal pocketbook and helpful to them. And by giving them the right to vote, they're going to vote for continual handouts. And that's what we see in our day. People who refuse to work, they can work, but they refuse to. And they vote, and of course, the Democrats now make them their slaves. Boy, that's politically incorrect for me to say, but the fact of the matter is, some of these people who won't work and can work, Dabney would argue should not have the right to vote. So all of these changes would corrupt American politics. The result is that self-defense invents illegitimate modes, and the unrighteous assault on property is met by the illegal use of property to protect itself and to inflate itself until the moral corruptions wrought in our politics fester to putrescence and dissolve the body. Under a thin veil of radical democracy, the government has already become an oligarchy. And it is Washington or Wall Street which really dictates what platform shall be set forth and what candidates selected and what appointments made, not the people of the states. So Dabney saw what was on the horizon, and the agrarian society would be pushed out and the industrial society would come in. And he saw problems that could ensue as a result of that. Well, Boyd Cathy, this guy that I was talking about, said a couple of years ago, I shared Robert Dabney's passages with a writer and columnist Pat Buchanan, who was so impressed by them that he quoted portions in one of his nationally syndicated columns. So most of you know the name Pat Buchanan. At one time, he was a candidate for president. So Boyd Cathy says his hope is that Dabney's works may be better known or more widely diffused among a newer generation that has witnessed the failures not only of the managerial state but also of the ineffectual modern conservative movement. But I'm just going to close with a couple of the sayings of Dabney. He says, "I predict that the time will come in this once free America when the battle for religious liberty will have to be fought over again and will probably be lost because the people are already ignorant of its true basis and conditions. Also, it is the teaching of the Bible and of a sound political ethic that the education of children belongs to the sphere of the family, and it is the duty of the parents. The theory that the children of the Commonwealth are the charge of the Commonwealth is a pagan one derived from the heathen Sparta or Plato in his heathen republic and connected by regular logical sequence with legalized prostitution and the dissolution of the conjugal tie. As a moral and social institution, a weekly rest," here's he's talking about the Sabbath, "is invaluable. It is a quiet domestic reunion for the bustling sons of toil. It ensures a necessary vacation in those earthly and turbulent anxieties and affections which would otherwise become inordinate and morbid. It brings around a season of periodical neatness and decency when the soil of weekly labor is laid aside and men meet each other amidst the decencies as a sanctuary and renew their social affections. But above all, the Sabbath, one day of rest and seven, is necessary for man's moral and religious interests." So moving to Thomas Carey Johnson, a successor of Dabney, not his immediate successor, who wrote a 600 and some page biography of not only Dabney, but Benjamin Morgan Palmer. And he's quoting Benjamin Morgan Palmer here. "Dr. Dabney's death was widely noted and lamented by the papers and periodicals, religious and secular, in all sections of our own country, in Canada and in Great Britain. Also, it was remarked and deplored. Many just and beautiful tributes were paid to his memory. Dr. B.M. Palmer wrote in the Southwestern Presbyterian, 'The recent death of Dabney distills a tear of sorrow from many a suffering heart. He was truly a prince in our Israel, a pillar of strength in the house of our God. How we shall miss him, who leaned upon him for a defense in the great battle for truth in the sinful world. He was mentally and morally constituted a great polemic.'" And if you want to see an example of that, when Darwinism first started to be read and accepted and so on, if you compare Dabney in the way that he took apart the philosophy behind Darwin's theory of evolution, is so much more thorough than Charles Hodge and Benjamin Warfield, because he was such a gifted writer and so analytical when it comes to false teaching and able to just destroy it from within like a presuppositionalist. Nobody takes apart, as far as the major theologians, the doctrine of evolution as Dabney did. So Palmer says, "How shall we miss him who leaned upon him for defense in the great battle for truth in a sinful world? He was mentally and morally constituted a great polemic with a massive intellect capable of searching into the foundations of truth and with an intellectual as well as moral indignation against every form of falsehood. We find in these natural abilities the secret of his strong convictions and the fearless utterance of them which distinguished him through life. A great writer of our own times has said that love of truth is honesty of reason, as love of virtue is honesty of heart. It was this twofold honesty that made Dabney the Christian warrior that he was. Loving truth for herself, he sought her as one might seek to win his bride, and so his convictions went down into the substance of his whole being. His holy reverence for truth wrought in him a holy intolerance for error, and he fought for the one and against the other with a passionate earnestness which many mistook for bitterness of spirit. Yet with these sturdy qualities were united the gentler traits which oftener than is generally supposed are blended in the character of those who were truly great. All who were admitted into the repose of Dabney's inner life recognized those amiable virtues which endeared him to his pupils and to friends of every degree. The sweet simplicity of his character and the genuine modesty which veiled, while it did not conceal his greatness, made it easy for others to rejoice in his preeminence without the infusion of jealousy. It is only the loftier natures which look upon their own achievements as being such that others might have wrought as well, end quote. Well, so much is left out of this that I cover in his biography. You have to interpret a man like this and the times in which he lived and the pains that they knew that we just simply do not. And I covered this in the biography of Dabney, which I will probably add to this church series. And he had six sons from his wife, and three of them died at a very young age. And if you saw the how it just tore him up to hold his son in his arms while he's passing away, and the grief that this man went through. And there's so much about these men in a bygone day that we forget how hard life was for them. Now, whether Dabney was too bitter at the loss of the South. In fact, for a while he was contemplating the idea of moving with others to Brazil. He didn't even want to be under the reign of this Union North over the South. But he was brought around and ended up going down to Texas to teach philosophy at the University of Texas. It may have marked his character, but unfortunately, I think in our day, people look at these characteristics that they can look through their rose-colored glasses in our day, and they can't see Dabney in the times that he lived, but there were still things that he wrote that are such a instruction for us in our day.